Hi, I'm John Schwanis, and on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers, we'll explore the opioid crisis from several perspectives, all in hopes of answering one key question. Is the war against opioid abuse ultimately winnable? And if so, what will it take to secure victory? Indiana Lawmakers, from the State House to your house.
What if a robotic arm could help disabled students reach for their dreams? It does. Introducing RoboDesk. To learn more about this and more than 400 other world-changing Purdue technologies, visit otc-prf.org.
Okay, I know statistics make for lousy TV, but when it comes to conveying the impact of the opioid epidemic in Indiana, numbers do speak volumes, so bear with me. Nearly 1 in 20 Hoosiers report having taken opioid painkillers for non-medical purposes. More than 100 Hoosiers, on average, die from drug overdoses every month. Last year, parental drug abuse was responsible for some 60% of the instances in which kids were removed from their homes by the State Department of Child Services, and Indiana University estimates that the opioid crisis cost the state as much as $1.8 billion a year in lost productivity. Joining me to flesh out those numbers are Republican Senator Jim Merritt of Indianapolis, a leading architect of the General Assembly's war on opioid abuse, Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill, who before becoming the state's chief legal officer just over a year ago, spent 14 years as Elkhart County prosecutor, and Larry Landis, executive director of the Indiana Public Defender Council since 1980. And that, ironically, was the year the highly regarded New England Journal of Medicine published a letter that some researchers now blame for fueling the opioid crisis. The one-paragraph letter, written by physicians at Boston University Medical Center, asserted that, and I'm quoting, "Despite widespread use of narcotic drugs in hospitals, the development of addiction is rare in medical patients with no history of addiction." Well, there you have it. How did we get... I'll start with you, Jameer. Okay. Where we are now. A lot of societal ills, you can say, there was malevolence lurking somewhere in the that gave rise to this ill. This came about because researchers were trying to ease people's pain. So how do we get here?
It did start with pain, and it is so widespread in reasons why this epidemic came upon us, and it came upon us not relatively quickly, but incrementally. And I do believe that we are changing the culture of this state and this country from a law enforcement problem to an illness. It's not a character flaw, and there are a lot of people who have had a surgery or had some sort of situation where they have fallen into. A pill valley, if you will, and once the pills are cut off, they go to heroin, and now
which
the
is
attorney general
cheaper,
says,
actually in many
yes,
cases
so it's
than
very,
the prescription
it's a lot
medication
cheap since we were kids, and we have fentanyl in our state now, and whenever you hear of a drug overdose death, fentanyl is probably involved.
So, not a character flaw. You just summed 38 years into. But you say the key here and the challenge you've had is persuading people it is a disease and not a character flaw. And I'm guessing you may or may not be convinced that it is entirely a disease and not a character flaw.
I don't think it's an either or necessarily. I think if you look at opioid and its origins, it was intended to be medicine for acute pain, pain from a surgery, temporary relief for a very serious situation. If used in that context and managed and controlled, it can be a very, very vital substance for people who are suffering from great pain on a temporary basis. Over the years, it's been desensitized to being more for acute purposes or not taken as seriously in terms of the repercussions. And so along the way, what's happened is more and more people have relied on opioids as a way of pain relief in situations that really wasn't required. And that's where I think a lot of the addiction issues have occurred. Coupled with that, though, it's a very complex issue. That's one aspect. But we also have a very addictive society or society that is substance-oriented, whether it's alcohol or other substances that get involved. So this has really been a conglomeration of factors that have culminated into creating a crisis that's really going to get a lot worse before it gets better.
Who deserves most of the blame in your mind? Is it physicians? Is it drug manufacturers? Is it drug wholesalers? Is it pharmacists? I guess they're just filling the prescriptions. I mean, is it who? If you said, okay, I'm going to go find the people, the organization, the group of institutions that deserve blame, where do you put the finger?
I don't think you can single out any particular entity. Certainly, you would look at manufacturers in terms of representations that they've made. You can look at physicians in terms of their responsibilities to their patients, in terms of providing the right care and the right follow-up. But you also have to look at people themselves in terms of their own responsibilities for identifying or understanding what they're putting into their bodies and what the repercussions of that system will be. So I think it's multi-level.
Larry Landis, we have one vote for a disease, not character flaw. We have one vote for part disease, part character flaw. Give us your vote.
Well, I think it's obviously a disease. Okay. Addiction is not a character flaw, because most of the people who have the opioid addiction now, you know, got it not because they went out trying to find drugs to inject into their body. They went because they were seeking relief from pain. That's not a character flaw. If you want to attribute the blame, I think you have to start with the pharmaceutical companies. I agree with Curtis Hill. Pharmaceutical companies, even long after they knew that opioids were addicting, still perpetuated the fraud of it's not addicting. That was their message, that they trained their pharmaceutical salesmen to go out and tell doctors it's not addicting when they had research showing that it was. Doctors also have to accept some of the responsibility. They overprescribe opioids long after they knew the addicting features of opioid, and of course consumers love to just pop pills. We're a pill popping society. We want immediate relief from everything. We want immediate gratification. We want immediate relief. So we're all to blame. But I agree that individuals have to accept responsibility for their own health. So ultimately, that's the person who has to say, I got to pay attention to what I'm putting in my body. But tragically, if you look at, have pharmaceutical companies and the medical profession ever been held accountable? No. No more than really executives from tobacco companies. No one's ever gone to jail, even though they are perpetuating things that are very harmful.
Well, we do have any number of lawsuits now that cities, counties, states are buying into. In fact, I think just this week we had brought the announcement that the city of Evansville and maybe St. Joe County, I believe, your former neighbors up north,
we're going to join dozens,
if not hundreds of communities just in Indiana who are looking at targeting individuals or companies that have been distributors and manufacturers.
Yeah, but if you look at what happened to the tobacco companies, what happened? They had to pay a part of their profits, right? And they continued to do what they were doing. Which actually made cigarettes more addicting by injecting nicotine into tobacco. Pharmaceutical companies, sure, they'll pay a little piece of their profit, but will any of the people who made the decisions to perpetuate the selling of addicting drugs ever pay a penalty, criminal penalty? No, they will not.
I mean, many of your colleagues across the country have joined these suits, and again, communities and counties across the state. Do you think that's a realistic approach to try to exact some justice through litigation of that sort?
Certainly. There are a number of states, and as you pointed out, my colleagues, and Indiana included, that are evaluating the process of what to do with regard to manufacturers, distributors. It's a very complex problem. We have been working on it for several months. I'm not in a position to talk about exactly what we're doing in terms of confidentialities, but it's a very complex issue of determining what that responsibility is for whether it's manufacturers or distributors. What did they know? What types of representations they made? So it's a good thing that the states are reviewing these processes. I'm somewhat concerned about the lawsuits that are springing up in various communities, because I know how complex these issues are, and I'm hoping that some of these smaller communities have the wherewithal within their legal departments to recognize how difficult these proceedings will be. No one should go into a lawsuit believing that, oh, we're just going to get a settlement. If we engage in a lawsuit, we're looking at it from the standpoint of what's the liability, what's our responsibility, how are we going to handle this thing if it goes out to full litigation, and that's why we're taking our time and evaluating it carefully.
Well, you would know better than I, but I think in many of the cases of the smaller communities, at least, they are working with firms in the case of Indiana here in Indianapolis, for the most part, that are handling a lot of these on a contingency basis. So presumably it's not the municipal legal sections that are bearing the brunt of this, the risk, but in fact some of the firms that are handling this. Again, you know more than sure. I about the litigation strategies, but that is something that you're still weighing and giving thought to.
Absolutely. I think it's a critical piece. I'm in touch with my colleagues across the country on a regular basis. There are various avenues that are in place. There's a large multi-state group that's looking at things. There's various states that are looking at doing different pieces of litigation. They're looking at manufacturers, they're looking at distributors. So we're looking at all of those avenues in terms of what's in the best interest of defining the problem here in Indiana.
And I want to get your take on these various strategies that have been employed. You're responsible for a lot of the ones that have already been mm-hmm. enacted, say, last session
right.
and signed by the governor. But I want to touch, before we leave the subject of how we got where we are, you both suggested that this is not a matter of choice. You're sort of just... You're not acting on your own
right.
volition on any yeah. of this. Tell me then why we still see some of the trends, regional trends or socioeconomic trends, if people aren't deciding, making decisions to take these drugs or abuse these drugs, why do we see it concentrated? I mean, some would say, I guess, poverty issues or the sense of hopelessness, or there is no gainful employment in certain pockets mm-hmm. of the state or certain areas, regions of the country. Mm-hmm. But doesn't that suggest then that it's more than... that there is some thought going into this, even if the thought is that there's a sense of dejection or
right.
hopelessness?
Well, first of all, I'm really pleased that the Attorney General is taking his time on a possible lawsuit. I worry about the coffers of local government investing in this, where the Attorney General has all the resources that he needs in the way of quality legal work, and as well as we didn't get in this quickly, and we're not going to get out of it quickly. The tobacco settlement took 10 years. There are too many Hoosiers, too many Americans dying today. This needs to be all hands on deck now, and we can't wait for a settlement. We have to have the fundamentals, and I do think that we're changing the culture of what's going on. And if you see a heroin highway coming up from Mexico in Cincinnati and you look in West Virginia and Ohio and Indiana, you can see that it is regional in some aspects. But then again, you hear about the Northeast and what's going on there. This affects everyone. It is comprehensive. It's not
the notion that it somehow picks.
No.
For whatever reason, is either socioeconomic groups or regional groups.
No.
You're seeing it now.
Yeah, it's a dozens of reasons why someone gets caught up in this world. And we're trying to get the fundamentals down. And it has to do with prescription reform. And Senate Bill 226 from last year, where we have 7 days of your first-time prescription, you can only have 7-day prescription
or
of opioids.
Or if you're under 18, right?
Right,
then the
right.
Same sort of thing.
We've had a lot of reforms with that, and I believe that we're almost 10% under the opioid prescription level of years
is
past.
Is it that much?
It's dramatic decline.
It was 4% quarter to quarter, maybe last quarter, and
right.
people were
and, you know,
celebrating that as a success.
Yeah, quarter over quarter, it was 67,000 less prescriptions in the second quarter versus the third quarter of 2017. But the Attorney General is correct. The opioids, we need them for pain, but it needs to be dialed down and centered on pain itself. And we go crazy after a surgery sometimes. And we just need everybody to... dial back a little bit.
Well, I talk about some of the specific measures that they're combating this, but again, you raise an interesting issue about those who have, or maybe stage 4 cancer, you know, terminal diseases and so forth. Are physicians going to be so fearful now that they're going to be under the bright, hot spotlight of scrutiny with the new system? Well, I guess it's now been a year old, and more physicians, more and more hospitals are coming on board to inspect.
Sure.
I forget what that stands for, but yeah. It's a fancy acronym.
Drug
monitoring system, so that physicians can, before they prescribe one of these medications, they'll type in and see if you're getting it elsewhere or if you have a pattern of abuse. But I mean, do you ever worry that physicians who should be prescribing these things, if in fact you think there's ever use for these things, The patients are suffering because of the of this heightened concern?
Well, we don't want physicians to be fearful of anything. We want them to accept responsibility for being more diligent in the care of their patients. I'm certainly not one that wants to see a great deal of regulation of medical circumstances. I don't think any of my friends in the General Assembly want that. But because of the nature of what's occurred, we recognize that there have been some gaps in the ability to manage particularly pills and opioids. So doctors should welcome some assistance to be able to control or manage the process.
And you do, I presume, support the notion of having everybody on hospitals and physicians, at least those who have licenses to prescribe controlled substances, 100% compliance, what, in the next year or two? I mean, are you supporting of that notion?
Absolutely. And one of the things that we were also looking forward to is Senator Houchin has a bill that has been relegated to a study committee now, but to provide additional oversight to OBOTs or office-based treatment. We're not opposed to office-based treatment, but one of the things we have to be concerned about when we're talking about any type of narcotic distribution is having accountability and standards so that we don't make the situation worse. We're seeing now that doctors, we want to manage the way that doctors give out pills because over the past years, they've given out too many pills in the sense we've seen the damage caused by that. We want to have office-based treatment have accountable standards as well, making sure that we have a central registry, for example, so that doctors can, before they give out medications to people who come in and they're going to go right back out on the street, they can see, are these people being treated someplace else? Because one of the dangers is the diversion of many of these narcotics in these treatment programs. I was disappointed that that bill has been put aside because these are the types of things that we have to manage properly so we don't create another problem of too many drugs being diverted.
Larry Landis, I mean, I wasn't suggesting, incidentally, in the introduction that your arrival at the in your current office signaled the start of this problem. It's just, I'm sure, a coincidence. But you have seen it from that perch develop. What is the biggest issue of the many headaches we've talked about, economic, the impact on our healthcare system? It's affected your agency quite a bit in terms of, you know,
certainly,
children in need of services who are being removed from homes with right. abuse, with parents who have substance abuse problems. Your folks are stretched more than thin, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the biggest headache for you in this whole mess and your colleagues?
The biggest headache is still the over-criminalization of drugs and drug addiction.
People are going to prison as opposed
going
to perhaps
treatment facilities. Yeah, we tend, when we address problems, to look at it from the lens of moralistic, judgmental punishment. As we kind of have that, that's where we start from. Instead of saying, we have a public health issue. Let's address it from a public health problem. If we did that, we'd probably have different strategies in place. We'd have, you know, like now where we're addressing the opioid problem by trying to cut back on the overprescription, but that has caused the heroin problem because people who have opioid addiction have altered brain chemistry, right? They are an addict. They will find something that will relieve the pain of being cut off of an opioid.
And somebody on heroin is not going to be caught through the inspect system or anybody.
And we are still approaching heroin as a criminal problem. And so what we need to do is say, okay, what are we doing to identify the addiction issues, and we're still really short on treatment services. There's many places in Indiana where you cannot get drug treatment, and if you want an in-bed facility, you got to wait 6 months. Well, that should be unacceptable.
One thing the state is trying to do is expand, I guess. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say addiction itself is a health problem. I don't have any dispute about that. But when we talk about the overcriminalization, heroin is a major problem on other fronts in terms of heroin distribution. So I don't want to suggest that, and I certainly don't think that that's the solution to simply toss out the enforcement angle. I mean, most people who have serious conversations about what to do about this problem understand that we need enforcement of our drug laws. We need treatment for people who are looking for treatment and even those who aren't looking for it. And first and foremost, we need to prevent. We need to keep people from getting into the system because we can't keep up with the numbers of people who need treatment that are getting treatment. We can't get enough people into treatment in enough time to balance the numbers of people that are becoming addicted and the situation grows. So addiction is a health issue, but we still have to look at what are we doing to keep the flow of drugs out of the communities, and that's a very important aspect.
Do you agree with Larry Landis's assessment, though, that it's been criminalized or overly criminalized? The prisons in our state, you know, are not exactly ghost towns now. They're pretty jam-packed as it is, and I know with diversion programs that's certainly an option in some cases.
I think it's an overgeneralization. I don't think that we've been over-criminalized. What we talk about from a societal standpoint, we create criminal legislation to manage the behavior and conduct of our citizens. And so from that standpoint, it's better for our citizens to not engage in antisocial behavior such as drug use and certainly drug distribution. That's an overarching issue. That doesn't mean that everybody who comes into the system needs to be buried under the jail. One of the most effective avenues to treatment that we have is through jail chemical addiction programs that are existing in county jails. And we're trying to do what we can to promote that throughout the system. I mean, a lot of people who need treatment are not in accessible treatment areas. The folks who are in our county jails are captive audience, and we've seen success and being able to provide them with treatment. Same thing with our state prisons. We've got some excellent state prison treatment programs, but if we don't have people there, they're not adhering to it. I'm not suggesting that everybody needs to go to jail to get treatment, but if it is an absolute viable option because of the numbers of people who are in prison, who are addicted, that's a focus where we can do everything we can to provide them as much treatment as possible.
Well, I know John, the state is.
Here's my point.
Sure.
If we look at jails and prison as our treatment facilities, we are on the wrong path. That's part of when I say over-criminalization. We think nothing of spending $30,000 a year to put somebody in prison, but we won't spend $10,000 to immediately provide some kind of treatment for them. And that's the heart of the problem is our resource allocation is skewed towards police, prosecutors, and in prisons, not towards treatment. We don't have a policy of let's have immediate treatment on request or treatment on demand. We don't have a policy of that. You cannot get treatment in the state of Indiana if you go and say, I've got a heroin addiction, I need treatment, and you need inpatient treatment.
Well, there's also a geographic obstacle, I think.
Right.
Some people in the southeastern part of the state have to come to Indianapolis, well, I guess, which is one reason
it's a terrible indictment on our system if the only way you can get treatment is to commit a crime to go to jail or prison.
But here's the reality.
I'm going to let the senator weigh in here at some point. He is the architect of this, I thought.
But here's the reality. When you're talking about someone who's addicted, you're not talking about someone who's operating on a rational brain wave. We would suggest it would be great. I need help. Go in and seek help. Most of these folks do not know they need help or seek help. I'm not suggesting that prison is the only way, but I'm suggesting that when they are captive in that capacity, that is an opportunity to take advantage of that. And some of these programs are very, very effective in getting it taken
care of. Jim Aaron, I know you've talked about this being a disease and so forth, but you've also been a proponent of harsher mandatory sentences. And maybe the distinction is, for instance, it's a minimum 10-year sentence for dealers who knowingly give people drugs that are laced with fentanyl, right?
Right.
Do you draw a distinction? I mean, where are you in this spectrum of the debate?
Distribution. And that's
versus
exactly right.
Users. So
exactly.
It's not a possession or use.
Yeah, we're not talking about a mule. We're talking about
big-time
drug dealers that death might become involved in a drug deal. That fentanyl is a part of it. I believe in 10 years of mandatory sentences if you are a drug dealer, and we have to send a message because they get it. We know there are county prosecutors that were in counties that were tough on crime, and the drug dealers went elsewhere. We have a $250 million problem in this state. We have 200,000 addicts in the state. And it's a comprehensive approach from law enforcement all the way to treatment. And the federal government is looking at $6 billion
of
the state.
Because right now the state, correction and other areas have funding, but only $5 million set aside specifically for the intervention.
Well, yeah, it's an enormous amount more money than that.
I know, but that's what...
Yeah, exactly.
You know what? You guys are just getting warmed up. And I could tell Larry Landis is leaning forward and wanting to say something else. And once we wrap this up and the cameras stop, you can continue the conversation.
And we will.
And I'm sure you will. I appreciate the conversation. You've taken part in thus far. It's an important issue for all Hoosiers, both those who are victims of this scourge and certainly those who are on the law enforcement side. Again, my guests have been Senator Jim Merritt of Indianapolis, Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill, and Larry Landis of the Indiana Public Defender Council. Will the state take over a school near you for underperformance or budgetary reasons? Ask the folks in Gary and Muncie on the next Indiana Lawmakers. And time now for our weekly conversation with Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight, now part of the Hanna News Service. I want to talk about the halftime report on where we are with various bills, since we are sort of in the lull here between the calm before the storm.
Justin Timberlake.
There you go. Anything to add to the roundtable, though, before we leave the subject of narcotics?
Well, the state will be getting involved in the multi-state litigation on opioids. The Attorney General just got
signed off. Have you told him yet that is going to happen?
The Inspector General just signed off on a contingency fee contract with a national law firm, and the state will be following up on that.
All right. There we go. Halfway point. Tell me about the bills that you're surprised to see that are still moving and those that sort of have said bye-bye for this year.
I think everybody was surprised by the demise of the smoking bill. I think there's some surprise about the bias crime bill biting the dust, and there are a few others, and obviously the slowness now with which the legislature is going to approach the workforce development issue. But I'm going to be keeping my eyes on a few different issues. The gun issue and the abortion issue, I think, still have the potential to light things up. But there are a couple of other things that are of some interest. The school takeover bill, I think, is going to get very controversial in the second half of the session. We're going to hear a lot more about this workforce development, workforce realignment bill in the next couple of weeks. And there are some real issues with some of these bills with respect to money.
The issue is this is not a budget year, as lawmakers often point out. So substantially, you can't do much that would have a fiscal impact. Is that not right?
Right, but just like with Congress right now, all of a sudden we're seeing a push for bigger deficits. We're not seeing that in Indiana, but we are seeing a lot more spending. We're seeing a lot of money being diverted under this workforce realignment bill. We're seeing money being diverted from the software as a service bill. We're seeing money that's being put into education, put into the public schools to make up for some problems with not the formula, but with actual enrollment. And I think when you start adding these things up at the end of the session, you're going to see some real money involved.
People get nervous when you start talking about diverting money, but I know what you mean. Ed, thank you. We got to leave it there. I appreciate your insight. For more information, episode streams, and other extra content, visit us on the web at wfyi.org/lawmakers. You can access live streaming coverage of the General Assembly on the Internet as well. And remember, you can get our show on demand from Xfinity. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Schwanis, and on behalf of WFYI Public Media, Indiana's other public broadcasting stations, and my colleague Ed Feigenbaum, I thank you for joining us, and I invite you to visit WFYI.org for more State House coverage. Until next week, take care.
What if an app could give a voice to children silenced by autism? It can. Introducing SpeakAll. To learn more about this and more than 400 other world-changing Purdue technologies, visit otc-prf.org.